This is Whitley Strieber, and this is Dreamland. You've reached the edge of the world.
What is a soul?
Do animals have souls? Cats? Dogs? Well, today we're talking about Soul Dogs, A Journey into the Spiritual Life of Animals by Elena Manis. This is a perfectly beautiful book that speaks deeply to me, because the dog is my spirit animal, as some of you know. And after the show, there's going to be the full hour of the show, and then for 15 or 20 minutes, I'm going to tell you my stories of my experiences with dogs in the soul level, because they are extensive and beautiful. But that's not what the show is about. The show is about another journey, an absolutely marvelous journey taken by our guest. Elena, welcome to Dreamland.
Oh, I'm so happy to be here. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, thank you for coming. And as soon as I saw this book, I thought, must do this. Must. And I read it, and I am right about that. It is a delight from beginning to end. Now, let's start, though, way before the beginning of our lives and the beginning of the book, and go back into prehistory, where you have at the start of the book a brief description of some evidence that people treasured and reverenced dogs way back in the distant past. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes, well, I mean, we really know now from archaeological evidence and research that it's really obvious that dogs and humans have evolved together through the centuries for many, many years. And I found it particularly fascinating that archaeologists had discovered the remains of dog burial grounds, for example, I believe in ancient Israel and in other locations, indicating that those people truly honored and respected their dogs, their dog companions, and arranged them very carefully in death, which showed really a deep caring for these animals. And it's really tens of thousands of years ago that it's now believed that dogs and humans started their evolutionary journey together 145,000 years ago. And that location in Israel actually was an ancient Ashkelon, a city that's half an hour now from Tel Aviv. And the dogs' bodies had been placed on their sides with their legs bent, very flexed, very carefully, and their tails tucked around their hind legs. And there's another burial ground in Germany that they found a dog who had been buried with their humans. So I find it just really remarkable, or in a way not remarkable, I guess, that that this dog-human bond goes back so far and seems to really be built into both us, we humans, and into dogs.
Well, now let's talk a little bit about you. Elena has told us a bit about dogs, and we'll find out more in a moment about her relationship with dogs. But Elena herself is a remarkable woman. She's an independent documentary director, writer, and producer. She has 6 Emmy Awards, a George Foster Peabody Award, 2 Directors Guild of America Awards, 9 Cine Golden Eagle Awards. She has written, directed, and produced series and documentaries for CBS, PBS, ABC, and the Discovery Channel, including one of my all-time favorites, The Amazing Animal Mind. So, Elena, you're really a very, very accomplished individual.
Well, thank you so much. I have been saying, though, since I have worked on this book and now it's coming out soon, that it's really made me look again at the journey I took with Brio, the dog I write about, and how, in a way, you know, I'm very happy I've had this great career and accomplished things, but in a way, I truly feel that my greatest accomplishment is the journey I took with Brio, my dog. So we'll be talking more about that.
Oh, yeah, I am aware of that. That's why I was so careful to start with dogs and then move on to your background, just to give the listeners a feel for who you are. And because you've done some beautiful and important work in the area, in the area of film and television, and that needs to be known. Now, let's go back to what happened to you that brought Brio into your life.
Well, I was really, you know, I was in the midst of my career. I mean, I suppose one could say sort of at the height of my career. I was really doing well. I was very ambitious and hard-driving. But then I had a near-fatal car crash on a film shoot, which really did shake me up, not to make a pun. And those things do make you sort of look at your life and think, you know, maybe there's something more than just work and trying to achieve the next thing. And I had always loved animals. I'd grown up with cats, who I loved, but I always wanted a dog. And I thought, well, maybe this is the time to get a dog. And I had a long-term relationship with a man that had ended around that time period not so well. So I, you know, looked to get a dog for the usual reasons, I guess, for companionship and that unconditional love that everyone tells you about when you're when you get a dog. So that was how it happened that I set out to get a standard poodle, because we'd had family friends who had standard poodles who I loved. So that's how it all started. But I was I'm the last person that I ever thought would have written this book and have taken the kind of journey I took with this puppy that I brought home.
Yeah. So you bring a puppy home. That seems like a simple thing to do. Many of us have done that and found out that it's actually quite interesting. can you tell us a little bit about what happened when you brought this little bundle of fur into your house and put him down?
Yeah, well, many things happened that most of them were not according to plan. Really expected that, you know, I knew that I would have to do training, but I really thought this puppy would kind of be at my command, at my beck and call, and he would be cuddly, and he would do things that I wanted him to do, and, you know, just not be a bother. But quickly I found out that Brio, as I named the puppy, which stands for energy, it's sort of a musical term for energy and gusto, which certainly did suit him, that he really had a mind of his own. He was extremely independent-minded. And as he started growing older and we went out into the park, I mean, he just didn't listen to me. He wouldn't come back. And I was unbelievably frustrated. I mean, I write in the book about an incident that sort of stands as a metaphor for what was going on. As usual, he wasn't coming back one day in the park, and I was yelling and screaming for him to come and walking backwards so I could try to see where he was off in the distance. And all of a sudden, I realized that there was nothing beneath my feet, and I had stepped over the edge of a small boat pond in the city park, which fortunately wasn't very deep, but I was now standing in water up to my thighs. A most embarrassing incident.
Yes.
But it sort of stood from the situation between Brio and me that things really seemed out of control, and I had stepped over the edge into an unknown world of a puppy that I really couldn't control. And I just didn't think he even loved me. I mean, I felt, you know, this bond that I expected to have really didn't seem to be there at that point.
So here you are with a little puppy in an apartment in Manhattan, I gather. Yes.
Yeah.
And you're going to be taking him. The first place that crosses your mind has got to be Central Park.
That was Central Park. Yeah.
Yeah. So you started going to Central Park with him. What was that like?
Well, as I've just said, that was for the pond, jumping into the pond.
It was the pond.
Incident was.
How interesting.
So that was one incident. In another case, I sent him off with a trainer in hopes of, you know, changing the situation. And he ran off with a trainer into a pond and came back covered with green algae, both he and the trainer.
Yeah. Well, I know other people who've fallen into the little boat pond in Central Park. It's something that happens. In fact, so you weren't alone in that respect. And, of course, it being in New York, people just take it pretty much everything in stride. But you have here a dog that is, comes from a hunting breed. He's very active little guy. He's highly intelligent, easily bored. What are you going to do? How did you cope?
Well, I did get trainers, and that helped some. But, you know, I had this concept, as I've said, that this was going to be sort of a master-commander relationship. And that, you know, I loved animals, but I guess I basically felt they were sort of here to serve me if I brought one into my life. And, you know, I was realizing that that wasn't going to be the case. So I was just, you know, I was frustrated. I was sad. That, you know, I couldn't seem to build a good relationship by my standards with this little dog. So, you know, I had heard that there were people who called themselves animal communicators who said that they could read dogs and other animals and really know what they were thinking and feeling. So, kind of on the spur of the moment, one day I researched and found out the name of one with a good reputation in California, all the way across the country, and I called her up and I asked her if she could tell me about my puppy. I really didn't say anything about him except his color and his breed, I think. And she gave this really remarkably accurate reading about that seemed to be from his point of view, describing my apartment and the streets around where we lived and what he liked, et cetera, et cetera. So I was pretty amazed because I was that's why I said I'm the last person I ever thought would write this book, because I was a big skeptic about anything like this, you know, anything that we now call woo-woo or about the paranormal. I was trained as an investigative television journalist, and I really didn't believe anything unless it was proven by empirical fact. So it was a great leap off the edge, so to speak, for me to even call an animal communicator. But that is how this journey started, journey.
This was Samantha Curry?
Yes, that's correct.
Yeah, and you also had to read Diane Sawyer's dog.
Yes, I did. I mean, once I had had this initial reading with her and Brio, I was by now even more intrigued. So I persuaded ABC, for whom I was, then working, to let me do a story about animal intelligence and the animal mind. And part of that was about animal communication and telepathy. So I got Samantha to come to New York and to read Diane Sawyer's dog. And again, she gave an amazingly accurate reading about Diane's dog, a setter, and said that he'd had some traumatic incident of falling when he was a puppy, and that turned out to be true, that Diane said he actually had fallen into a swimming pool when he was younger. So this was just one more piece of evidence that was leading me down the path of being convinced that there really was something going on with telepathic communication between humans, or at least some humans, and dogs, animals.
Well, dogs are, you know, they and cats, actually, are both have remarkable, I think, telepathic abilities. I think that they live in a state of telepathy that we don't realize they live in, actually.
I totally agree. I mean, I wouldn't have said that at the time, but by now I absolutely agree with you.
Yeah, they're simply picking up on us all the time. And I wonder often if they realize we don't reciprocate, that we can't hear them. I often wonder that, especially puppies and little kittens. And I think as they grow older, they realize that we're actually not hearing them, and they change their behaviors accordingly, which gets me very briefly to a droll story that comes up in the book early on. It's a study of It's a study of the fact that it turns out that dogs will be more likely to steal food that they've been forbidden to take if the lights are out. Do you remember that? You wrote about it.
Yes, I absolutely do.
Well, tell us about that. That's a great, funny story.
That's funny that, you know, they really have figure out our behavior, and that was a study done by, I think, Julianne Kaminski at the University of Portsmouth in the UK, and she showed with the study that dogs can tell when a human is likely to see them maybe doing something bad. And so they figure out that they can sneak stuff when the human isn't looking or able to see them, and that they're four times more likely to steal food, for example, that they'd been forbidden when the lights were off, say in the kitchen or whatever. And, you know, I think that's really a very, very interesting study. And I think anybody who's had a dog knows that they sneak. They know at my dogs. No, I have a second one now. They know absolutely when I'm distracted or not paying attention.
Oh, yeah.
They could go do something bad.
Well, my dog knew the rules of when I was a little boy that my parents had laid down for me and would bite me in the behind hard if I violated them. There were trees I wasn't allowed to climb, which I, of course, climbed all the time. But when I came down, Candy would come out of nowhere and wham, whack. That hurt.
That's great.
Okay, free dreamlanders, we are going to take a brief break. We'll be right back. We're talking to Elena Manis. Her book, Soul Dog, A Journey into the Spiritual Life of Animals. Beautiful book. Is there any place we can reach you on the internet, Elena?
Yes. The website for the book is www.souldogbook.com, and there are links there to order the book, which is available now. So you please take a look and order.
Yeah, do, because it's very inspiring, and it's going to make you look at your dog in a new way. And just maybe your dog has been waiting for that, because there's a whole different level of relationship that we are told doesn't exist, but it does. Tell us a little bit about when you began to realize that there was something about your relationship with Brio that was a little beyond what you had expected.
Yes, some of it was because of the communicators, that they really helped me to realize that he was totally a thinking, feeling being in his own right. And I do believe, in fact, they would say to me sometimes that, you know, he's glad that you get him or you listen to him. But I certainly, in those early days, I was no expert at listening to him, for sure, but I was getting a little better. And he had a quality, which I call a presence, for lack of a better term. It even gives me chills now to think of it. And it wasn't just me, but other people who picked up on it. It's very hard to put into words, but he had a presence and a wisdom, and he took up a lot of oxygen in the room somehow, that you had to look at him, and he had an impact on people, like people who worked in my home or that I took him around to places. Strangers would feel or say that they felt something special about him. Once I was consulting a Ayurvedic nutritionist for myself, and I happened to take Brio along for reasons I can't remember now, but I walked in for the appointment, and this man, the doctor, takes one look at Brio and says, oh my goodness, he's an old soul. And, you know, he continued to focus on Brio throughout this whole session, what was supposed to be about my nutrition. But that was very affirming to me, that it wasn't just me who felt this quality in him, that other people did as well. So I just felt that even in the relatively early years with him, that he had things to tell me about life and existence, or he had a just something I was supposed to learn from them. I don't know how else to put it, really.
And he came into your life as a puppy after you'd had a major accident. That's correct.
Yeah. That's correct, yeah.
And why in particular did you choose, I mean, you already mentioned why you chose the particular breed, but why did you want a puppy at that point, a dog?
Well, as I said, I mean, I think the outward reasons were that I, you know, was sort of, you know, shaken up by the accident, felt, you know, I wanted more in my life and just working myself to the point that I was going crazy and that I'd had this relationship that had broken up, so I wanted a living being in my life. But, you know, I think there may have been, or the word,
but I'm trying to explore whether or not you have any sense that there might have been something deeper there.
I actually do now.
I didn't
understand that then. But I think he came, or was given to me, if you will, to, you know, be my guide in this, in which I fully believe that he did come to be my guide or angel, whatever term one wants to use, at that point in my life. Whether, you know, I sought that, I certainly didn't seek it in that way consciously, but I think he knew that. I always felt that he knew more than I did, or I came to feel that. I mean, he would look at me, and it was just like he knew me, even when I didn't really know him very well.
You have a wonderful chapter in the book that talks about sheepdogs and the working dog and watching them work, which I also have done, and I'm sure many of our listeners have too. It's truly a magical experience. I've watched Australian cattle dogs. I'm from South Texas and know them well. Watched them doing their work down in South Texas and watched the joy in those dogs when they work, when they do what they were built to do. The love of that work. And my own little dog was a rat terrier. She was like nothing better. It's a highlight of her life to kill rats. So, anyway. You have this relationship building with Brio. At first, it's a struggle. You see, Brio's a puppy. He's peeing in all the wrong places and doing all the wrong things and just being a puppy. And you're running around trying to figure out, why did I do this to myself? Am I insane? Right?
Oh, yeah.
Pretty much.
Then
go ahead. Go ahead.
No, I'm sorry. Go ahead. I interrupted you.
No. It's you. We want to listen to.
Well, that was just so true that, you know, I just had many a day and many a night where I think, why have I done this? What have I done? You know, like, what happened to my life here?
Right.
And which is what drove me to try to gain some sort of understanding of him, you know?
Right. Because, you know, poodles in particular are very, very smart animals. I think that might be the smartest dog breed, if I'm not correct. Or right?
They say that sometimes. So poodles and border collies. Different kind of intelligence, I think. But.
Yeah. In what sense different? Because that's very critical.
Well, I think poodles are very creative. Certainly not regimented at all. I think border collies, you know, they have a mission, a job in life. I mean, I've never had one, but from everything I've observed and been told, that they really are made to do that job of managing sheep. And because of that, they have this remarkable ability to communicate with humans, even in a very special way. Not that all dogs don't have an ability to communicate with humans, but as you said, to watch a border collie and his or her handler work together is just a remarkable demonstration of communication between people and animals. And I went to this event with a very famous, well-known border collie handler and author, Donald McCaig, who really feels that there is something beyond explanation, beyond the whistles and the hand signals and the body language, that really is a kind of telepathic communication between the dogs and the handlers.
Yeah, well, you know, I was at one of those demonstrations it must have been in Yorkshire years ago, and I actually asked one of the handlers, I said, it looks like you have a telepathic relationship with the dog. And he said, of course I do. We couldn't work together otherwise.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's great.
Yeah. And I think there's something to that. They are relating to us on a level that we ourselves are kind of anesthetized to. We're not aware of that part of our relationship, but you became aware of it with Brio, very definitely. And we're going to take another little break. And for Free Dreamlanders, we'll keep going right on after this. So stay with us. And after that, we're going to talk about how this other level of relationship developed between this remarkable dog and a human being who was being desperately challenged to look at life in a new way. We'll be right back. We're talking to Elena Manis, her book Soul Dog, A Journey into the Spiritual Life of Animals. It's a wonderful book, and the thing that makes it wonderful is that it is so empowering. Your own dog lying there in the kitchen or in the living room floor or out walking with you. You have a great relationship with your dog. But there's more. And you're probably, being a listener to this show, you're probably well aware of the more. But let's listen to Elena tell us how it felt to become conscious of the fact that her relationship with her dog was more than it seemed on the surface. Elena, why don't you tell us when you began to realize that this relationship was not just an ordinary, or what we call an ordinary relationship, there was something more there.
Yes, well, it evolved, but certainly as I began to consult more and more often with the animal communicators to let me know what Brio was thinking, what he was feeling, it was, first of all, so clear that he did think and he did have feelings. And the first level, I would say, I guess, of my realization of who he really was about that he was an equal being to me, not an inferior being. And secondly, that this amazing thing was going on, that he was actually talking, communicating to me, I guess, but through the animal communicators, about what he wanted to say. And, you know, he said things about me and what was happening in my life that I wasn't even thinking. I mean, sometimes as a skeptic, I would ask myself, well, maybe these dog psychics are actually reading my mind. If I accept that there is telepathy, maybe they're reading my mind, not Brio's. But I came to not believe that at all, because they would come up with things that from that Brio was saying, that there's no, it was totally out of my mind, that, you know, things that I wasn't even thinking about or that were so clearly coming from Brio that I could not deny it. So that was the second huge revelation, that there is this communication or connection between living beings, even the two different species, that crosses boundaries of space and time. And that's a huge thing. That's a big question. You know, how can that happen? What does that say to us about the nature of life and afterlife? You know, I mean, if these communications are crossing time and space, what does that really mean? And I'm learning all this and asking all these questions because of a dog. I mean, the whole thing was unspeakably amazing to me, and I never would have thought I would, you know, be experiencing something like this.
Well, describe some of the experiences, if you will.
Well, with Brio, first of all, he had health problems, and he had a major collapse when he was around 8. He couldn't walk, and the Western doctors, which I took him to all the vets, and I spent a lot of money doing every test known to man and neurological scans, et cetera, et cetera, and the prognosis was that he had a degenerative neurological situation that he probably would never walk normally again, much less run. And I was already consulting animal communicators, and I learned about one who also did or claimed to do long-distance energy healing. And she connected with Brio over the phone. She'd never met me. I didn't tell her anything except that he couldn't walk. And she said at the end of the session that he would be all right, that there was nothing wrong with his spine and neck, as the neurologist had said, and that she would work on him a few more times, but that he'd be okay, and he was for several more years. So that was one more confirmation that something was happening over a long-distance line between Colorado, where she was, and New York, that I couldn't explain by ordinary materialistic means. It was outside the realm of our five human senses.
Could it be that you were being taught a lesson of some sort here, that there were other levels of energy and other levels of reality that were kind of waiting for you to discover them?
Absolutely, and I believe now that that's, you know, really why Brio came. I mean, that was it has changed me. It's changed how I look at myself, how I look at existence, how I look at life and afterlife.
And now it's time to start talking about that subject, specifically life and afterlife, because nobody lives forever. And dogs are no exception to that rule. And there came a time when Brio passed.
Yes, there did, which, of course, was incredibly difficult to have his physical presence go. I mean, the very experience of his passing was one, something I'll never forget. He, at that point, was really failing and having seizures, and I knew the time had come, finally. So that was there, and of course I was holding him. I mean, I spent that last day together all the time, and I was holding him through the whole event. And when the vet, you know, put in the injection, I felt this amazing kind of spiraling sensation that was going around and around in a spiral, and I was holding Brio and kind of going with him. And I really, you know, felt that I was just going, frankly. But I had one of the animal communicators on the phone with me as moral support, I guess.
Yes.
And she explained after it was over that that was his energy spiraling out and expanding, having been kind of compressed in his physical body. And so that in itself was a remarkable experience. And then in the days after and continuing, still continuing, the animal communicators and even a medium who reads spirits in the afterworld, whether they be animals or human, continued to communicate with Brio and convey to me messages that were so accurate, amazingly accurate. For example, about where I'd been, what I was doing, when somehow it seemed, you know, Brio had somehow been aware of that and was with me and reporting to, I think to give me proof somehow that he actually was there somewhere in spirit. You know, there were messages describing how I'd been in some restaurant, whether it was a smoky fire. It was and is remarkable. I mean, now I accept it as truth, but in the beginning it was jaw-dropping, I guess would be the term.
Well, you come came to this the same way we all come to this. We live in a state of anesthesia. We are, our bodies direct us into the material world, and soul is there for us to discover or not. It's our choice. Now, you had just come off of a very hard time, and as Brio got sicker and sicker, you began to ask him this, make this poignant request, never, ever leave me. That's a beautiful, beautiful part of the book. And in fact, you know, the energy, this book is full of real spiritual energy, soul energy, folks. So if you get, you know, most of us can't get up off our duffs and actually buy a book. But if you love animals and you love dogs, you will find some sustenance in this book that could frankly re-energize or even build a new level of relationship with the animals around you. It's that strong. You wanted a pact with Brio. This is where now you know he's dying, and what is going on in your mind? I know the anguish of losing a dog or a cat. Most of us do. What is going on in your mind as you are trying to communicate with your dog at this time?
Well, I mean, there was the fear of losing him physically, of course, and, you know, just desperately trying to make sure that my connection with him was not going to end, you know, that somehow it would continue. And I'm so touched that you pick up on that, you know, phrase that I said to him over and over. You know, and I asked him to send signs, and which has come true. I mean, I'm more and more, and you know, as years pass, I mean, I'm able to feel his presence directly myself. Initially, you know, I really needed a lot of support from the animal communicators and the medium, which really, as I said, helped convince me that he really is there in spirit, and he hasn't left me.
Now, do you have any friends, people you know, who are also in communication with their departed animal friends? Are you kind of in a group of people with similar experiences?
Well, I wouldn't say I was in a group, but especially through writing the book and talking about my experience, you know, I've run across people who say, oh, yes, you know, that they have had the same experience or believe in the same way that I do now. And certainly writing the book, I've discovered others who, some of them use animal communicators, some have not, or have come to this realization more on their own, but there are more people than I ever would have guessed out there who have had and are having, you know, experiences of communicating with their animals, dogs in spirit. I mean, there are people who have heard their dogs barking in the night in ways that seem very convincing. I've met somebody who actually felt the footsteps of the dog on the sofa. It was a little chihuahua who she could feel him walking along the sofa. I mean, other stories like that. And even people you wouldn't think would be believers in this sense, like the border collie handler I met, Donald McKay, I mean, has had experiences when a dog has passed. And he and his other dogs sense that dog has died coming back in spirit because the living dogs react and start barking. And Donald McKay, for example, has had this experience more than once. And it turns out, I discovered in the research that this actually is kind of a phenomenon that some researchers have observed in humans, too. It's called after-death communication, ADC, you know, that
yes,
people so strongly feel the presence of a loved one.
I have a whole book about that experience with my wife called the Afterlife Revolution, which my listeners know well. I'm very involved in this, and not only with my wife, but also with many other people and animals that have been in my life as well. So I'm quite familiar with this process. Brio comes back. The night after Brio's passing, all the lights in the house went out. No storm, no power outage in the area. The fuses just blew inexplicably. Was that your first sign?
I believe it was, yes. Yeah. I mean, there was no
it's
way.
It's a familiar
one. I mean, I lived in a place then that there were storms and the power would go out, but there was no storm. It was perfect weather. I mean, there's no explanation why a fuse would have blown, you know, and everything in the house went out. I mean, it was, you know, I really believe it was Brio.
There's some kind of energy involved in this that's very connected to the electromagnetic. It's not electromagnetic energy, but it does affect that type of thing, certainly. Now, so someone said to you, it was Brio showing you he was still around, and how did you react to that?
Well, I believed it. I mean, I was, that evening, I was kind of in shock. You know, the whole thing just seemed kind of not real. And, you know, I didn't want it to be real, of course, but I certainly was not my normal kind of practical self. So, but, you know, I did believe it because there's no explanation other than, you know, in some way it was Brio. I mean, as I said, it felt like some energy. I mean, the energy in the house was so strong. I mean, it felt like he was there.
Now, you meditate, and you were meditating during this period, and we haven't talked about Brio and flower shops, and Brio loved flower shops. Is that... go ahead.
You know, he did indeed. I mean, it was, he would just pull me into flower shops in the city, and, you know, it wasn't that he wanted attention from the people or wanted treats or something. He would just sit in the middle of the store, and you could see him kind of smelling. You know, he would just sit there and enjoy the smell of these blooms all around. So, you know, I would, you know, when he pulled me to go in, I would increasingly just say, okay, we'll go in, and he would take up his position and sit there smelling. It was like a meditation.
What's interesting is this isn't a canine behavior.
Dogs, no, it's not.
Dogs aren't interested in smells like that. They're, as we all know, they're interested in much different smells. And yet here's a dog who was smelling the flowers and maybe taking you somewhere, too, when he did that.
Yes, I mean, really, there's a message in that. You know,
there is.
Yes, too, as we're talking, you know, take time to smell the roses. That's the saying, right?
That's right. Open your door a little bit into parts of the world that you normally ignore, as he was doing, into a part of the world he would normally be expected to ignore. Now, he's passed, and tell us about the humming. I forgot about, I want to get back to the story more linearly now. Tell us about the hummingbird and the frog.
Well, in the days before he passed, I had sort of come to the decision, and he was really pretty much incapacitated. I would have to carry him outside to do his business, and, you know, I knew that, you know, the day that the vet would come was a day or so away, and so I just spent every minute with him. I was living in the country at the time, and so I would sit on the kitchen floor with him, you know, with the summer, with the screen door open, and there were all these remarkable appearances of creatures that never had happened before in that way. First of all, a frog was on the stone path leading up to the door, and just stayed there for a long, long time, which had never happened before. And then a hummingbird came up to the screen door right, you know, on the other side of where I was sitting with Brio, and also stayed there for quite some time. I mean, I had seen hummingbirds, but nothing like that. Just this endless hovering. And, you know, after that, I've learned that both the hummingbird and the frog are kind of symbols and mythology of resurrection and spirit, so to speak. And I really believe that they had come to usher Brio on his journey, kind of welcome him into the spirit world. And then also throughout his lifetime, Brio had this odd affinity to attract four-leaf clovers. He would sort of sit down or stop somewhere, and there would be a four-leaf clover. And I started collecting them because it was happened a lot. And I think it was the day before he passed that he was lying outside on the grass, and I went over to him, and all of a sudden, right in the middle of his flank, there was a four-leaf clover.
My word.
I still can't get over that.
No, of course not. Now, he has left you. He has passed on, and you are wishing, like we all do, that your loved one was in some way still here. You're on the beach. You see, tell us about the footprints and the call to dawn and so forth, that whole wonderful story.
Yes, well, he had passed, and I was up in an island in Massachusetts where I go when I can to find some peace and respite from the city. And, of course, you know, it was a very emotional trip. I had Bria's ashes, and I wanted to scatter some in the ocean, which he loved so much. He loved to go to the ocean. So I had sat on some rocks right above the beach and scattered some of the ashes there and also into the ocean itself. And I called one of the animal communicators, I think it was the day after this time on the beach. And she, I didn't ask questions. You know, I would just say, tell me what Brio was saying or something like that. And Dawn, in this conversation, said, well, he's saying that he was with you at the beach when you had his ashes. And she went on to describe that I was sitting on a little knoll, I mean, which is sort of the rocks above the beach, scattering the ashes, which there's no way she could have known that. And she also, at the same time, I think, described that I had fed him a pound of roast beef right before he passed, and my last day with him physically, which also there was no way she could have known. The footprints in the sand, I did see footprints, and I thought, well, could these be Brio's? And, you know, it made Dawn and the other psychics more credible when they didn't always agree with sort of a guess of mine like that. She said, no, there are not those. Those are not his footprints. But she didn't go with me on that, but she certainly had described the scattering of the ashes, which I didn't tell her that. There's no way she could have known that and described where I was when I did it. So incidents like that just continued to validate that what was happening was real, that these messages were coming from Brio.
I'll give you an example, folks, from the book. She writes, I called Sylvia, who's one of the animal communicators, from my office at my house in the country. There's a chair where you are now. It has wheels, she said. I see Brio with you now. There's a door to the right. He's looking in the door. That's pretty trim at the bottom of the wall and a wood floor. There's a wood window opposite up against the corner. He's standing there in the doorway saying, I'm here. As she was speaking, you looked at the door to your right, almost convinced that you would see him. How accurate was her description of the space that you were in?
Totally accurate, down to the detail. I mean, even details I'd never made a point of noticing, like the wood trim or something. I mean, I wasn't thinking about that. Certainly, I'd never told her. She'd never been in the house. You know, she was many miles away.
Yes.
You know, it gives me chills just hearing you read that, frankly.
You know, my wife, after she died, said a very interesting thing. She said, from here, it looks like you're all intentionally ignoring us. And she's always says, I'm here. I'm right here. And I think Brio was saying exactly the same thing, wasn't he? I'm here. I'm right here.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, it was just, you know, even to this day, I mean, it's not that I don't believe it, but it's still, you know, I wrote those words. I experienced it, but it's still, you know, every time I go back and remember that, it's you know, there's a level at which, you know, I don't think the human mind can totally absorb it. I mean, we have to go into that other dimension somehow.
Yes, and you mentioned people, of course, I knew in my past, the remote viewing team and Ingo Swann and such people as that, with whom I had a certain amount of connection at one point in my life. Now, you have gotten to the point where it's time to think about another dog. How did that feel?
Well, I really did want to get another dog, but initially I really was hoping that Brio would somehow reincarnate in another puppy, and I went through some months of desperately searching for the puppy that would conceivably be Brio reincarnated and looking for clues and signs. And I had strongly believed, actually, in reincarnation as a child. I had an experience that, you know, I just somehow remembered something that I knew. And, of course, as we become adults, all that gets poo-pooed, you know, and you sort of lose that conviction. But I was certainly interested in exploring the possibility that Brio could come back. I really wanted him to. And I ended up finding a breeder who had a puppy, an older puppy, a year old, who'd been born on Brio's birthday. So I thought, ah, that's the sign. I'm going to go. So I go down there, and I didn't connect at all with that dog, but it was a younger litter. And I did find a black puppy, black standard poodle puppy that I liked. So I sort of, again, took the leap, and I got him. I mean, I love him, but he's a very different creature, different personality, different spirit than Brio. He's kind of a young soul. Brio's an old soul. But I'm so glad I have him. And they say that you get the right dog at the right time. So I think he is a wonderful dog for me. But I do believe that animals can reincarnate. I don't negate that possibility at all. But in this case, I know that Brio is not Bravo, the name of my new dog, that he didn't come back as Bravo. Not to say that maybe Brio could come back sometime, who knows. But I think what I say is I really have an open mind about reincarnation, and we'll see.
Well, yeah, I do too. Souls are souls, though. It doesn't necessarily hold true that a human soul always reincarnates into a human body. There can be, in fact, I don't think you could say that the soul is human and that soul is dog, et cetera, and so forth. There's a wonderful phrase a friend of yours had said that you mentioned in the book about Brio. You can see the pyramids in his eyes. Can you expand on that a little bit and tell us what she meant and what you concluded from that?
Yeah, I mean, it was, well, in close-ups of Brio, there was sort of a depth and profundity in his eyes that it's that wisdom and the presence that I was speaking about earlier, that some very deep quality that lives in his eyes. And even now when I look at that photograph, I feel it. And, I think his soul was coming through his eyes, you know, that old soul that in some way other people seem to recognize, even if they didn't call it by that, you know. But it was very powerful, very powerful.
And I wonder often if animals remember previous lives. I don't know if you had any sense of that at all.
he may have. I mean, because he was so unusual, I believe. You know, as a person, I don't personally remember previous lives, although I did have that one kind of memory as a child, but it's not something that, you know, I think of every day by any means. But, you know, I think it's quite possible that animals can remember previous lives in the same way that some people seem to be able to.
Yeah. Now, one of the things that has very much followed you along through this whole experience are certain spiritual teachings. Can you tell us a little bit about the spiritual teachings that speak to you and that have been speaking to you since your experience with Brio began?
Yes, well, I mean, I'm certainly not religious in the sense of believing in an organized religion, but as you say, over the years, I've really sought to go inward into myself more through meditation. So, I mean, the teachings that resonate with me are, I guess I would say, the mystics, whether they, you know, I did a film actually about a Catholic mystic priest, Father Thomas Keating, and his teachings were one of the first meditation practices that I started using and valued that a lot. It was really about going into the silence. And more recently, I've followed the teachings of a man called Joel Goldsmith, who came out of the, originally he was a Christian Scientist, but he split from that and became much more of a mystic. So the teachings that attract me are ones that are don't have an organized church or that are non-denominational, that are leave room for the individual soul to find its own way. I think personally, I believe that, you know, we each have our own way, and, you know,
yes,
we have to find it ourselves.
That's right. And there are as many religions in this world as there are beings. And each one of us must find our place on the path. My wife always says the human species is too young to have beliefs. What we need to have are questions, which is a wonderful thought, I think, because if you look back across history, people are always trying to kill everybody who doesn't believe what they believe because they know in their hearts that it's not enough. We don't have the truth here, but you touch on it a little bit in this book, I think, and in your life that has been basically a very secular life that was radically changed by a relationship with a dog. Remarkable. Soul Dog is a book that has obviously moved me very much. You can go on the website of the book, souldogbook.com. And I didn't sense that, that Elena wanted to talk about her professional life very much. So I didn't bring that up, but she has a professional website, manusproductions.com. I would urge you to explore Soul Dog quite seriously, no matter what kind of pet you have in your house, because I know the way spirit works very well. And the very fact that you're hearing this means that someone is probably calling you and saying, hey, wait a minute, time to look deeper into your relationship with me, whoever that is. Whatever animal it happens to be. Now, after the show, and in fact, what I'm going to do next is I'm going to talk on my own about my own relationship with spirit animals, which is very extensive. Many of you have heard these stories before, and you needn't listen, but it'll be there for you if you would like. Right now, I would like to say goodbye to Elena Manus. It has been a very moving experience to talk to you. And to Brio, who I felt very strongly in this, was present the whole time. Soul Dog, a journey into the spiritual life of animals. If there's anyone in the world who can wake us up to the sensitivity, beauty, and extraordinary reality of our souls, it's our dogs and our cats. Thank you, Elena, so much for being with us.
Oh, thank you. It's been an honor and just an unbelievable pleasure. Thank you so much.
I've had a lot of relationship with animals in the afterlife. And it started with my little dog, Candy. Candy was a rat terrier. When I was 7 in 1952, my mother decided it was time for me to have a dog. So she took me out to a dog farm, she and a friend of hers, where they had rat terriers. A rat terrier isn't really an official breed, but it's a very smart little relative of the fox terrier who is bred to kill rats. And Candy was really an expert at that. In any case, as we walked up to the run where the little dogs were, the puppies, my mother said to me, "Now, Whitty, your dog will choose you. You just have to stand there, and there will be a dog who comes over, and that's going to be your dog." So I stood there, and there was a cute dog with a Charlie Chaplin sort of mustache on her face that was sort of looking at me. And I said, "I want that dog." And Mama said, "No, that dog has not come over. That dog is just looking at you a little bit and looking you over, but I don't think she's your dog." A few minutes later, right? 2 minutes later, not even 2 minutes later, another dog walked over to the edge of the cage and sat down and stared right at me. And Mama said, "Well, your dog is here." And so the lady who ran the kennel got the puppy, and we put the puppy in a box, put the box in the car, and went home with the puppy. And we got home, and I entered into the deepest relationship I had known to that time in my life with my little dog, Candy. Candy was on Mother's side and on Annie's side. Annie was our maid and our caretaker for us kids as well. And anything I did that she knew that I had been forbidden to do, and she knew everything I had been forbidden to do, would get a bite in the rear end, as I said during the show. So I had to be very careful. Candy and I slept side by side in bed for years, all of my childhood, in fact. And Mother would say that during the secret school years, that Candy would bark and bark and bark at something in the night, and they would go up to see, and nothing would be there. And sometimes I have a feeling maybe I wasn't there either. But that's another story. We're not talking about that today. In any case, when Annie first came down to Texas, she peeked into the bedroom where I was sleeping, into my bedroom, and saw me with Candy's head on the bed beside mine. And she said to herself, "Well, I have a rival." Well, not quite. But Candy was a dear, dear companion, and we loved each other deeply. And Candy came time after 24 years of life to pass away, which she did very quietly. One afternoon, she took a nap, and it turned out to be forever. She wasn't put to sleep or anything. Not long after that, I was lying in bed in our apartment in New York. I was stroking Candy, thinking how nice it was that she was with us. And then I thought, well, wait a minute, Candy's not here. In fact, Candy's dead. And I woke up and Candy was gone. But it had been so realistic. And over the years, that has probably happened now 10 or 20 times at least. I've sort of half waked up and been stroking Candy, and she's been in the bed. It's been very vivid. And then I think to myself something like, well, let's see. Candy must be, by now, what, 62, 63? And then I immediately think, oh, no dog could be that old, and I wake up. Now, this happened a few years ago. It happened in, I guess, early 2009, probably about February or March. And it came with a very strange dream. The dream was that I was driving down a country road that was quite narrow with hedgerows on either side, and car lights appeared. I was with Anne, and I realized that we would die on this road. And then I woke up. Of course, I told Anne all of my dreams in those days, because you told Anne a dream and you got back the most knowledgeable dream interpretation you could imagine. Annie was a master of dream interpretation. She was a very mysterious woman in a lot of ways, and that was one of them. Anyway, I told her the story, and she said, well, that road is a death road. If we're ever on it, we need to turn around right away, because Candy has sent you a message. It's a warning. That summer, we went to the town of Devizes in England to the Crop Circle Conference that's held there annually, and we had a wonderful time, and Lucy Pringle had invited us to go to Stonehenge for a special evening session at Stonehenge, and we rented a car, and we were driving along, and all of a sudden, everything fell together. We were on the road. Annie knew it, too, immediately. She said, Whitley, turn around. And at that moment, car lights appeared in the distance, racing toward us at breakneck speed. I was confused because I was driving on the, for me, the wrong side of the road in England, and it was dark. And I realized our lights weren't on, and I couldn't figure out in that desperate moment how to turn them on. The other car could have no idea that we were even there. I managed to get the rental car pulled off into this hedgerow on the side of the road, and that onrushing car raced past us at least 50 miles an hour, and they never even saw us. Never saw us. But because of the dream, and because of Anne's astute dream interpretation and excellent memory, our lives were saved by Candy. Since then, Candy has appeared many times. And I thought to myself, after Annie passed away, my goodness, is Annie gone now? What about Candy? Are they both gone? And all of a sudden, I saw clearly in my mind's eye Annie standing there with Candy on a leash. And I knew that they weren't gone, neither one of them. My girls are still with me. Now, I'll tell you the story about Quagmire. And you've heard this before, I'm sure, but you might enjoy listening to it again because it's a powerful story in its own innocent way. When Annie was still alive, I was meditating one afternoon, and suddenly I saw in my mind's eye, but very clearly, a dog from my teenage years called Quagmire. Quagmire was always happy, even though he had no reason whatsoever to be. He lived in a very unpleasant place. The master of the house had bad PTSD from the Korean War, although we had no idea in those days what PTSD even was. Quagmire used to get beat up a lot, but that didn't matter. He was dirty. He was a quagmire, and he was always happy, and he was always friendly, and he was always on your side, no matter what. You talk about unconditional love. He was the very embodiment of that. So there was Quagmire, and I told Anne all about this, and she immediately said, dog, God, you had a visit from God. And I said, well, I'd have to have some kind of a sign if I was going to believe that. A few minutes later, we went walking, and there standing on the street corner was a car with the vanity plate QGMIRE, Quagmire. And so ever since then, I have understood that that was a visit from God. And my own dear beloved teacher had taken me down another extraordinary path in our life together. Annie, I mean. So those are some of my dog stories. Both of our cats showed up immediately after they died. My first cat that died, Sadie, came jumping in the window of my office and stayed around the house for a couple of weeks after she passed away. I could see her from time to time. I would see her passing. And then the other one, Co, he was put to sleep. He had to be put to sleep. Sadie died quite dreadfully. She was the victim of something that went wrong at the cabin, and this is what it was. There was a purple-pink plasma hanging in the living room one night, and I looked down from the cathedral balcony, I could see the glow from my bedroom, and I rushed out thinking the house was on fire. Looked down and saw this plasma hanging over the sofa, and both cats were moving toward it, and Sadie was in the lead. And I rushed back to the bedroom to get a camera. There was a bright purple flash that briefly filled the whole house. And then when I went back, the thing was gone, and both cats were all curled up asleep on the floor. I could not wake them up. So I went to bed myself. The next morning, Sadie had purple-pink tumors in both of her eyes, and she had to be put down. And then the afternoon after she was put down, here she came, jumping through the window of my office into my office in Brooklyn Heights, where we lived at the time. So that was the first cat who came back. And then the second one, Co, after he passed away, he was also had to be put to sleep because of cancer. He arrived very confused in my bedroom in San Antonio at this point. And I turned him around and picked him up with my spirit hands and my turned him around, and there was light there. I could see it, and I tossed him forth, and off he ran toward this level of energy that is where we all dwell in the spirit form, and everybody does, from the smallest, most humble little plant to the greatest seer and the greatest philosophers. Jesus said there is no all or equal in the kingdom of heaven, and that is literally true. So off he went. Then years later, Annie, 2004, had her near-death experience. And in her near-death experience, who shows up but Co, saying, these stupid humans, they can't even find their own way in the world of the dead. And that was typical of that arrogant little Siamese guy. I am the one who got him oriented in the world of the dead. Then my wife comes along, and he's contemptuous of her because she's not oriented in the world of the dead. Okay, little guy, I love you anyway. And I'm sure you're going to be there for me in some improbable way soon. Anyway, I just thought I would tell you these additional stories of animals in the afterlife and my own life. And I do hope that you enjoy Dreamland and enjoy listening to this show, and that you come back often. Dreamland is a very special place in the world. There's nothing else quite like it.
You've been listening to Dreamland. Be sure to tune in again next week. Dreamland is brought to you by UnknownCountry.com and its family of subscribers. Unknown Country was founded by Ann Streber. Our news editor is Matthew Frizzell. Our coordinator is Amy Safrankova. Whitley Streber is your Dreamland host. And I'm your announcer, Ted Alexander. Thank you for listening.